content of the following program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, treatment, or cure. Always consult your physician or a health professional with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition.
One Life Radio is brought to you by our sponsors. Great companies like Sun Warrior, the pioneers of plant-based protein. From the sun to the plant to you, go to sunwarrior.com to learn more about all the products and use the code OLR for 20% off your order. Enviromedica, makers of Terraflora, a novel broad-spectrum symbiotic combining spore-form probiotics and advanced food-based ancient prebiotics. Find Terraflora and the full line of products at enviromedica.com. Castor and Pollux, the new standard in pet food, the only complete line of USDA organically certified pet food. Crazy Water, infused by Mother Nature, not some random factory. Paleo Magazine, now all digital. Go to paleomagazine.com to subscribe. The Wellbeing Journal, Veg World Magazine, the International Society of Sports Nutrition, and Thorne Research. Visit our dispensary at oneliferadio.com for 20% off and free shipping. You can find more information on all of our sponsors, including links to listener discounts, on the oneliferadio.com sponsor page. Thank you for listening to One Life Radio.
Go higher, baby. You're in the right place. You're listening to One Life Radio. This is Bernadette with Junior, broadcasting live from Dallas, Texas on iHeartMedia, as well as KMET in sunny Southern California on ABC News Talk. How you doing today, Junior?
I am doing amazing. Yes, got you, a big day today. So my friend, you remember I was telling you yesterday, we have some friends that are living with us because they're building a new house and it's not ready yet.
Yeah.
So the guy that's living with us, it's his birthday, so we're having a few people over and gonna watch some football. And I'm excited for it.
I love that. That's the Italian in you. You know that, right?
Oh yeah. We everybody's got to come to our house. We got a big island crowd around. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I love it. Thursday's my night where, you know, my daughter goes to her father, so I typically dance and I'll watch football during football season. I'm not sure who's playing tonight. Who's playing?
I have no idea. I've been so worried about everything else.
Yeah,
I think it's the Bucks because I think I heard Brady's going to be playing tonight. So I just don't know who they're playing. But you know, it's football. I just watch it. It doesn't really matter to me.
I know. Me either. I love football so much. It doesn't matter who's playing. When they're playing, it's camaraderie at the end of the day.
Exactly.
And connection, which is something we're actually going to be talking about here in just a couple minutes. You know, I wanted to read this little poem as a segue into our first guest, Shelby Scarborough. She is the author of the book Civility Rules, and this is actually a poem from the beginning of it, and she's an incredible authority on protocol. Wait till you hear her bio, the rest of it. But in the front of that book, Civility Rules, which I pre-ordered, it comes out November 17th. I ordered it on Amazon yesterday. You're going to want a copy. It's a beautiful, just wonderful book. It really is. And so here's the poem that was at the beginning of the book, and it's The World We Make. It goes like this. We make the world in which we live by what we gather and what we give, by our daily deeds and the things we say, by what we keep or cast away. We make our world by the beauty we see in a skylark's song or a lilac tree, in a butterfly's wing, in the pale moon's rise, and the wonder that lingers in the midnight skies. We make our world by the life we lead, by the friends we have, by the books we read, by the pity we show in the hour of care, by the loads we lift, and the love we share. And I'm about to put... I'm about to cry.
Gotcha.
Oh my God, I'm really feeling this. I am. We make our world by the goals we pursue and by the heights we seek and the higher view, by hopes and dreams that reach the sun and will and a will to fight till the heights are won. What is the place in which we dwell, a hut or a palace, a heaven or hell? We gather and scatter, we take and we give, and we make our world. And there we live. Isn't that beautiful?
It is very. Wow.
I know, right? Okay, now that I'm ready,
got everybody in the fields now.
let me introduce Shelley Scarborough. And I might mention at the half, we've got Von Eaglin coming up, a regular on the show. We're going to be talking about the myths and the truths about dysfunctional relationship. It's hard to say all those words without sounding like I have a lisp. But I love this woman, the book that she wrote. Let me just tell you a little bit about her. So Shelby Scarborough is the author of Civility Rules and an authority on protocol. She's worked with U.S. presidents and foreign leaders, including Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Richard Nixon, as well as international leaders such as Queen Elizabeth, Margaret Thatcher, and Nelson Mandela. Her diverse career includes government affairs, international relations, entrepreneurship, philanthropy, and fundraising. In 1990, she founded Practical Protocol, a special events management and business protocol training organization. And Scarborough also served as the global board chairman for the Entrepreneurs Organization, a network of 12,000 entrepreneurs around the world. Her website is ShellyScarborough.com. Such an honor to have you on the show. Welcome, Shelby.
Thank you so much. It's an honor for me. And hearing that poem, I have to say I practically needed to blow my nose.
Oh, my gosh. I just love it. I was very touched by it. And I've actually never read a poem on the air today or before. So today was my first time. So
it does take a little bit of guts when you get into it, because it is an emotional poem. And when I ran across it, I didn't write it. But when I ran across it, it just said everything I've been trying to say for a very long time. And so I just thought I needed to give some credit where credit's due and put it right up front and set the tone for the rest of the book.
Yeah, well, I'm so excited for it to come out. I've already ordered a pre-copy. I might even go get a couple more for Christmas presents this year, because it's so beautifully written. I actually printed it out on my printer, so I have most of it here with me. But wow, what an astounding book. What a much-needed book right now, especially with the state of affairs of our nation, especially, and the world as well. We're all together on this globe. And so let's talk about this. As someone who has worked in the White House with many dignitaries, you've observed civility in the political arena for years. So what does it mean to be civil in this kind of environment?
Well, I think what we have to break it down to is something that is more than manners. This is about much more than being nice. This is about respecting other people. This is about being trustworthy with our word and our actions. This is about empathy and showing empathy and compassion for other people, and courtesy. Courtesy is where manners live. But courtesy is much greater than manners. And manners change with time. So what we do with each other now may be different than it was 100 or 200 years ago. I'll give you a quick example. Courtesy, body space between Americans typically was about 3 feet, was a comfortable distance between people. Well, in the last number of months, we have now redefined what courteous distance is, and that would now be 6 feet. Mm-hmm. So while these things change over time, the bottom line is being courteous to our fellow man is still and always will be an important concept.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we've seen some examples of such incredible discourtesy recently with politicians with the presidential debates. It was unconscionable what the American people saw as it unfolded live in front of all of us. And I know a lot of people were very disturbed by it, and rightfully so. But in your opinion, when did protocol and civility start to decline in government in particular?
Well, about 10 years ago, I started this journey by writing a chapter for another book, and it was exclusively on political civility. And in my research, I sadly realized that incivility in politics specifically has been never existed in some ways. The term mudslinging exists for a reason, because they actually slung mud. I hate to sound so negative about it, but I think we have to recognize that the dynamic in politics brings out sort of the worst in our politicians and in all of us. However, that doesn't mean we have to accept it at all costs, and nor do we need to replicate that behavior. And for me, it's about taking personal responsibility. We can't change necessarily the way our politicians behave, but we can vote, we can express our displeasure with it. And the presidential debate is a very good example of that, where my estimation is that they did a disservice to the American people both parties were vitriolic and not civil in their discourse with one another. And that is basically showing disrespect for the American people.
Agree. I totally agree. And so, you know, what does real civility look like? We started talking about it just a couple of minutes ago, but what does real civility look like, Shelby?
So if we take our own responsibility for it, we have to ask ourselves, am I earning the trust of my fellow man, whether it's in my family, my community, et cetera? Am I being respectful to the people in front of me, to the people in my world, whether that's online or in person? And it's really easy when we're online to be anonymous and to be very brave and to say things that we probably really shouldn't say. And just to be able to step back and take a breath and realize, put ourselves in their position, which is the empathy and compassion part. And if somebody else is reading what we write in our quick response because we have a flash of anger about something, which is a natural human response, but that we have the responsibility to control our actions and be a part of a bigger community and not just a man as an island.
I couldn't agree more. And I love in your book in chapter 3, you talk about personal responsibility. Everyone needs, in order to be civil, that's a huge part of it. For any mistake that you make is to take personal responsibility for it, right? Because that's the only way you can grow and learn.
That's correct. And to take personal responsibility for creating what I call my practice of civility. And I share that sort of recipe in the book that I take steps to take to ensure that I try to have civil interactions with everybody I encounter. And believe me, it's not always easy. And I say, look, we're human. I can be an uncivil person. That's the first words of the book. Mm-hmm. This is not, if it were easy, they say everybody would be doing it. So I challenge myself, and I'm challenging anybody who wants to read the book, that this is something that we can do. And let's make a movement of civility. Let's take charge of our own behaviors and reward other people's behaviors. You know, judgment is so simple. But what if we were if we saw civility in action, if we caught someone in the act of civility, what if we stepped up and said, thank you for that act of civility. I want to express my gratitude and encourage you to continue because it's really refreshing. Maybe one interaction at a time, we can change everything around us by just behaving ourselves and just being the example for other people.
Oh, absolutely. You said gratitude. Gratitude's a part of this. Being humble is a part of this. Personal responsibility, as we've already talked about. So many factors play into your ability to be civil, right? And so how have the news media and social media played a role in the rise of incivility?
So you just mentioned humility. One of the factors I think that goes into this quite deeply is the lack of humility that is shown across the board through social media and through our news channels, et cetera. And it seems like a strange connection there is, why is it humility? Well, you know, there's so much opinion out there. There's not a lot of facts, and we have a hard time discerning the facts from opinion these days because they're all so mixed together. So humility, the intellectual humility, is when we come to the table and say, we have enough self-confidence and self-assuredness and self-esteem that we can present issues and options and have a point of view. But in the end, we also know that we could be wrong. You have to have that balance. Without it, you have either no self-esteem or you're complete hubris, which is over-egoed, et cetera. And then there's no room for discussion. Mm-hmm. So we have to find that balance of that teeter-totter right in the middle that we can come to a discussion and be able to be willing to learn and listen to learn, as well as to be able to present our views in a way that might be heard.
I love talking about this. I do. And I can't thank you enough for writing this book. We're talking with Shelby Scarborough. Everyone out there listening, her book is Civility Rules. It comes out November 17th. I've got a copy here that I printed myself from the digital version. It's just amazing. I'm loving this talk. We're going to go to break. More coming up here in just a minute with Shelby. You're listening to One Life Radio.
Just a little bit better. Find us on Facebook, hit like, and follow us at One Life Radio.
My air guitar. Oh, that's one of my all-time favorite songs, everyone. Welcome back to One Life Radio. This is Bernadette with Junior. We are broadcasting live from Dallas, Texas on iHeartMedia, as well as KMET in Southern California. And we've got Shelby Scarborough with us. She is the author of Civility Rules and the Authority on Protocol. She's worked with U.S. presidents and foreign leaders, including Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Richard Nixon, as well as international leaders like Queen Elizabeth, Margaret Thatcher, and Nelson Mandela. Her diverse career includes government affairs, international relations, entrepreneurship, philanthropy, and fundraising. In 1990, she founded Practical Protocol, a special events management and business protocol training organization. Scarborough served as global board chairman for the Entrepreneurs Organization, a network of 12,000 entrepreneurs around the world. Her website is shelbyscarborough.com. It is an honor to have you continue on the show with us, Shelby. Let me ask you this. So what are the steps that people can take to discuss difficult issues civilly with those holding an opposing view, especially right now? There is such extreme left and such extreme right. We've never seen anything like it in our country before. So what steps can we take?
Thank you very much. I think the first thing we can do is, as my sister says, listen to learn. And I would add learn to listen. The second step would be something that we use in the Entrepreneurs Organization. You know, we take a full day to learn how to talk to each other, and you would think entrepreneurs would be speaking a similar language. Mm-hmm. And we do, but that doesn't mean we always agree on things. And the best way for us to communicate with one another is when somebody presents an issue or what they're dealing with or has a perspective on something, we then ask clarifying questions. We don't jump in with our opinion, and we say we don't should on you. So we don't say you should do this. We don't give advice. We basically say, tell me more about this. I'd like to understand more deeply about this specific perspective on something. So if you're putting it into the context of politics, I'd like to know why you've come to this belief about this specific issue. I'd like to really know more. And ask those questions to understand, not to get your own opinion back in there or your own argument. And then in the end, it could be perhaps then you can say, here's my experience. I want to share my experience with you. And if that resonates with you, then perhaps there's another place that we can find common ground and we can continue on with the conversation after that.
That's a great bit of advice as well. But what was it like to work with over 12,000 entrepreneurs? I have to ask you, being an entrepreneur myself, I mean, they're like, that would be like herding stray cats, you know?
Yes, that's exactly the phrase I was going to use. And that's a very good image. It's like we are a bunch of different cats with our own minds and our own stripes. And yet we have this common bond of wanting to bring enterprising ideas and creativity to fruition and bring it out into the world. And most of us, I believe, want to make the world a better place with using whatever talents that we were born with or that we've worked to develop. So, you know, it's not a charitable organization. It's about being a better entrepreneur. But the way we farm it is we're not networking. We are a network. So what we do is we learn and grow and that, and we try to help each other in that process so that maybe we don't all have to make the exact same mistakes.
I love it. I do. And being an entrepreneur myself for many, many years, I didn't even realize there was such an organization. And I'll probably join if I can. I don't know what the criteria is, but you know, going back to what has happened to civility, especially here in the U.S., given the unrest and uncertainty in our country, what do you see unfolding in the next few years if civility continues to deteriorate?
Yeah, I do have a little bit of trepidation, a little bit of fear that we could devolve if we don't get a grip on ourselves. And again, I go back to personal responsibility. We can point the fingers at our leaders. We can point the fingers at our neighbor. We can point the fingers at everybody else. But what does that change? So it changes nothing. So the only thing we can do is work on ourselves and maybe have a discussion with other people that we can feel we can have that first discussion with as to how we can proceed further to spread that message and to help ourselves create a more civil society. Recognize that that's the only way. And I really mean this without exaggeration. There was a man that I listened to recently when I was at a board meeting for an organization called the Freedom Foundation of Valley Forge. And his name was John Harmer. He was the former lieutenant governor of California under President Reagan. He gave a speech to this, to our board, and he said, you know, if there's only one voice in the room, there is no democracy. And that was sort of my aha moment in this whole process of writing this book, in realizing what I was really getting at and what I was feeling in my core. It's, this is very important for our democracy, that we find a way to be civil with one another. Because if we can't have more than one voice in the room, if we can't have more than one opinion, we don't have a democracy.
I couldn't agree more. You know, people seem to take it personally, too, and react so strongly to someone who has an opposing view. Is there anything that we as individuals can do to change that reaction?
Yeah, you know the phrase when you were taught in school as a kid, if you, you know, the fire aspect, stop, drop, and roll. I don't know why that why that resonates with me, but, you know, there's sort of an emergent aspect to it. So it's sort of stop, think, refresh, you know, take a moment, take a breather before something comes out of our mouth that we might regret. And again, I go back to trying to understand the other person's perspective first before we launch into our perspective on something. And that is one of the hardest things I've had to overcome. And I'm not there yet. It's a constant practice.
Yeah, it takes work, you know, to be a noble person. And that's really, you know, being civil is about being noble as well. They go hand in hand, in my opinion. But, you know, in the days of George Washington, it seemed that people could have difficult discussions without becoming angry or disrespectful. Has human nature changed, or do you think that the circumstances have changed?
I think ultimately human nature is human nature. And there are things that are going to get under our skin. The pace and the tone of that has changed over time. It's really the rapid nature of our lives these days. You know, we don't have time to sit and think and ponder about things like they did in the old days. But, you know, they wrote these amazing documents, these amazing letters to one another. It took time for information and communication to go back and forth. And you had to be present with somebody. Think about things like just the basics of travel in the days of George Washington. You didn't go visit somebody for a night, an evening out. You went for a few days because the travel was sort of, so you had to spend time with those people. You had to learn how to get along under the person's roof and be a good guest. We've kind of, if you think of it those ways, we are just too rapid. Everything is easily put behind us 3 minutes after we're done with it. And perhaps that's one thing that's adding to this, to the impersonal and informal nature of our interactions.
Well, you know, you're making me think of a story in your book in chapter 6, Empathy. And it was a story that I just loved it. It was about Jessica and the backpack in the Shenandoah National Park. Can we talk about that? Because I think that's empathy is a part of this civility rules as well.
Absolutely. Jessica Buchanan. Her backstory is super important here. The story could happen to anyone that you're talking about, the backpack, but just as a little context, Jessica is a friend of mine, and she was kidnapped in Somalia. She was a U.S. aid worker. She was kidnapped and rescued by SEAL Team 6, and she has written a book about it. It's an amazing story of survival and just pure will. And she's such an amazing person. So she and I've talked quite a bit, and she shared a story with me about that really relates to empathy that you're talking about, that she was out walking with her family, hiking, and they saw this family walk by with a backpack and a shovel, of all things. It sort of was distressing at first, not quite understanding what was going on.
Yeah.
They caught up with them eventually, and what they realized was this family was basically releasing the ashes of a loved one. And just the very simple image that we just don't know what people are carrying in their backpacks. Mm-hmm. We don't know what people are carrying on their shoulders.
Yeah.
A simple backpack could have held a thermos of water and a ham sandwich. But what so much more substantive and so much more meaningful was the contents of that particular backpack. So if we give people the benefit of the doubt that maybe they're dealing with something, maybe their lives are facing something that we just don't know, and we may never know, because maybe it's none of our business.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Maybe they don't even know.
Yeah, and my dad, you know, my dad, God bless his soul, he gave me so many tools, and you don't even realize it till they're gone, you know, what some of the great tools he put in my toolbox. But now I am going to start crying talking about my dad, but you know, he taught me so much about being noble and about being civil, and it's almost like it's a lost art nowadays. But in your book, you talked about American pastor Rick Warren that said it so said this so succinctly, that humility isn't thinking less of ourselves, he said, but thinking of ourselves less. And I think that's the key to healing this country.
I do too. Putting other people first.
Yes.
Neighbor to neighbor, friend to friend. My best friend in the entire world and I disagree on politics almost 100% on the issues. Almost.
Yeah.
But at our core, we know who we are as people. We've known each other since we were 12 years old.
Wow.
And we know what our core values are. And when we lay those up against the issues of the day, we both agree on 95% of the issues. The disagreement is how we achieve mm-hmm. the goals of those issues.
Yeah. No, I have a friend. Same thing. I mean, I couldn't have described it any better. But yeah, it is difficult, but it is possible to be civil and disagree.
Absolutely. And that's my goal, is to have people understand that, kind of take it on board, wear it, put that backpack on, put that coat on and wear it more frequently, and wear it proudly and share it with somebody else.
Well, speaking of that, that's a great way to end it, because I'm going to share your book with many people. Civility Rules by Shelby Scarborough, you guys. It comes out November 17th. It's not one you want to miss. I'll just tell you that. I can't wait to put it into my library and give it to my friends. Thank you so much for jumping on the air with us today, and I hope you'll come back when it gets released.
You've made my day. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. That's my pleasure. All right, everyone. We're going to continue marching forward here on One Life Radio. We've got Von Eaglin coming up at the half. You're listening, as I said, to One Life Radio. We'll be right back.
I see the crystal raindrops fall, and the beauty of it all is when the sun comes shining through to make those rainbows in my mind. When I think of you sometime, and I want to spend some time with you, just the two of us, we can make it if we try. Just the two of us,
just the two of us,
just the two of us, building castles in the sky. Just the two of us, you and I.
You're listening to One Life Radio. Make sure you check out our podcast and get to know the show at oneliferadio.com.
I am loving the music today. High energy. That's what we've got here at One Life Radio. Welcome back. This is Bernadette with Junior and our longtime guest expert and friend, Von Eaglin, and he is a licensed professional counselor supervisor and works with two group practices in the Dallas area. He is also a certified couple relationship trainer and sees a wide range of clients addressing men's issues, anger management, abuse, and addiction, just to name a few. He is also a doctoral candidate at the University of North Texas in the Counseling and Higher Education Department. His PhD research focuses on couple relationships dialogue, and you can find him at Preston Place Counseling.com or follow him on Instagram at Von Talks. Von Eaglin, how are you doing today?
I'm great. What about yourself, Bernadette?
I'm great. I'm great. You can hear it in my voice, can't you?
You always sound happy as always.
Hey,
it's great to hear your smiling voice. So.
I come like Tom Brady. I'm prepared. I'm prepared. And I'm going to win the game.
All right. That's all right. That's all right. I like Tom. So.
Yeah. Who doesn't, right? Everybody likes a winner, right?
Yeah.
And I think, after all, I mean, I think he's pretty humble, with all things considered. I really do. But, you know, I love what we're talking about today, and I always love having you on the air. We're talking about the myths and truths about dysfunctional relationships. Okay, so before we get into the myths and truths about, there I go with my lisp, about dysfunctional relationships, how do you define dysfunction?
Dysfunction in relationships can come in a variety of different ways. I would say the first way we could probably define dysfunction, usually like when we look at the research and statistics, and a lot of this research is coming from the Gottman Institute because he's the preeminent couples therapist out there. Really, we're looking at a ratio. So there's more negativity than positivity, because dysfunctional couples have, I'll say it like this. functional couples, stable couples, have a 5-to-1 positive to negative interaction ratio. And when that ratio typically falls below 5-to-1, like 4, 3, or 2-to-1, usually one person says that I'm unhappy. And the lower the ratio, the more distressed the couple is likely to be. And usually when that ratio is about 1-to-1, technically the technical number is about 0.7. But when it's more like 1-to-1, like exactly the number of negative interactions to positive interactions, then dissolution of that relationship is pretty imminent. So they're going to separate if that ratio doesn't change. And it takes intentionality in order to change that ratio.
Intentionality. So I have a friend of a friend who is married with 4 children, okay? All the way from 14 to 2, you know, or 3. And it's just really sad. Their marriage is absolutely falling apart. He's just demonstrated very narcissist behavior, and there may be, even be some bipolar there. How does someone fix that? How do they fix that and keep the family together in such a dysfunctional relationship? It's gotten very abusive.
Gotcha. Well, the two things that really hold a relationship together would be trust and then commitment. If somebody has a mood disorder like narcissism, so I have, you know, several high-income clients, and it kind of is usually more common in the high-income area. Usually if someone's narcissistic, you're going to see a lot of things. They're arrogant. They lack insight. They're going to be hypersensitive. They have a very big ego, but they're also very fragile. Like they are going to be, angry at times. They're not going to take a lot of responsibility. They're going to be gaslighting. So the wife is probably going to feel like she's the crazy one in the relationship, or he's going to make her try to feel like she's the crazy one in the relationship. So with someone with a mood disorder, that's going to look a little bit different, because that's what we call having a comorbid issue. You're just not coming in with, you know, hey, we have poor communication. It's like your communication or your poor communication stems from a mood disorder that it will be pervasive within the relationship. Now, she probably may be, you know, codependent, or she may have some issues in terms of like boundary setting with him. However, by and large, like they're going to have to do a lot of work. And I see it a lot of times. And when couples come into my office, let's say if there's one person who has narcissism, and there's different types of narcissists out there, keep that in mind. But if someone's narcissistic, sometimes it doesn't end well for that relationship, especially when the person who's being run over begins to value themselves and they begin to like stand up for themselves, because it changes the homeostasis in the relationship. Like what was equilibrium before is no longer like this. I can't deal with this anymore. Like, so they get tired. They get sick and tired of being sick and tired, and they start standing up for themselves. So, but with the kids, it makes it much more complicated, because they have a lot vested inside the relationship. So,
Well, and she's the breadwinner too, which I think is very difficult. Well, that's very difficult for a lot of men, right? Yeah. To accept that.
I would say, well, not all men. Like, I've had guys come in my office whose wives or their girlfriends, and they live together. They make more. It really takes a guy who's comfortable in themselves. Usually if a guy has high self-confidence, they're not going to compete with their partner. Now, if you have low self-confidence, or you feel inadequate, or you have feelings of inferiority, or you have insecurities, a lot of times if you see a woman making more than you, you're probably going to feel some kind of way, because a lot of times guys, we base our, you know, our success, our validation, our respect on how much money we make. You know, like when we meet people, we size them up. Hey, what do you do? Because I'm literally sizing you up, even subconsciously. So, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's a societal thing, though. I mean, putting value more on money than a relationship or love.
So,
right?
Yeah, I would say that it is a societal thing, but, you know, the way men are wired, you know, women usually are attracted to men with resources, in a sense. Like, they'll take a guy, and I'm being honest with you, Bernadette. Like, if a guy is really ugly, but he has a lot of resources, like, they'll accept that because, biologically,
because they're whores.
I won't say that. But, you know, they're looking to take care of their kids. They want to feel safe and secure. That's an instinctual drive by women. And so men, a lot of times, we base our self-worth on, like, what we acquire, all the resources we have, and women, sadly to say, you know, but this is kind of how you're socialized. You base your significance on what you look like.
Yeah. So, well, no, we shouldn't do that anyway. You should never judge someone by what they look like, or love them based on what they look like, no matter how deep their pockets are, right?
Yeah. And Bernadette, if I see one more woman making duck lips on an Instagram post, and, you know, there's a difference between beauty and then hotness. If you ever get a chance, check out Joe Rogan. He talked about one of his podcasts, like the difference, like if you're advertising with hotness, then men are going to look at you as a piece of meat. But if you're advertising with beauty, that looks a lot different. So
I love Joe Rogan. I do. I'm one of his biggest fans. I've actually met him before, and we both are very into flotation therapy. And a lot of other things. We actually have a lot in common, and the way we think. But yeah, he's really cool. And I agree. I mean, I say it all the time. And you get on Instagram and you see these women just constantly putting it out there, it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, I want to say, enough with the duck lips. Put your boobs away. Put your butt away. And then I mean, you know, and it's not just women, it's men too, but it's just it's so old. Like you just want to tell them, "Hey, it's not attractive. It's just not attractive."
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, by the number of followers they have, a lot of people would probably disagree with you, Berta. Like, "Hey, that is attractive." But is what kind of attraction is it? So, if you're attracting hotness versus beauty, you know what I mean? Like, those are two different things. And well, again, if you're putting it out there and you want me to look at it like that, I mean, that's what I'm going to view you as. So don't be surprised when I treat you as such in our relationship.
Well, and a lot of guys use those images for material, if you know what I mean.
Going to the bathroom and kind of
whatever.
Rubbing. I don't want to go there.
Right, we're going to go to break. Since we went.
Okay. All right.
And get that out of the way. When we come back, more with Von England. Stay tuned, everyone. Okay. You're listening to One Life Radio. Okay.
On Facebook, hit like and follow us at One Life Radio.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to One Life Radio. This is Bernadette with Junior. We are live in Dallas, Texas, and KMET in Southern California. Von England is with us, and he is a licensed professional counselor supervisor and works with two group practices in the Dallas area. He is a certified couple relationship trainer and sees a wide range of clients addressing men's issues, anger management, abuse, and addiction, just to name a few. He is also a doctoral candidate at the University of North Texas in the Counseling and Higher Education Department. His PhD research focuses on couple relationships dialogue, and you can find him at PrestonPlaceCounseling.com or follow him on Instagram at Von Talks. We are talking today about the myths and truths about dysfunctional relationships. Okay, so Von, you've got five top myths about dysfunctional relationships. What's the number one myth about these kinds of relationships?
Well, I would say the quid pro quo arrangement would probably be the number one myth, because the myth is that the happiest relationships are those in which couples keep track of each other. Because, you know, you want to ensure, you know, fairness and equity and equanimity, whatever word you want to use. However, the research points out is that when one person becomes an emotional accountant, then there's something wrong, because fairness, honestly, is a fallacy. There's no such thing as fairness, because I tend to think you, Bernadette, know what I think is fair, and you think I know what you think is fair. But the thing about it, we both have two different ideas about what fairness is, and it always breaks down because relationships aren't fair. I'll give you an example, a personal example. So my wife and I made an agreement. She doesn't do well in the kitchen. I am the cook in the house. And so whenever we got married, I said, "Hey, you know what? I'll cook, you do the dishes." Now, after the third day those dishes weren't done, I looked at her like, woman, you're not holding up your end of the bargain. What is wrong with you? I actually had a contemptuous look towards her. However, nowadays, we've been married 16 years. We don't care who does the dishes. You know, at some point, they're going to get done. But
yeah.
Because I was becoming an emotional accountant, I was always keeping track, like, you're wronging me in some area, or I had a negative view towards her because I always had this perception like I'm being mistreated because I'm keeping track of every single thing that she does. And
yeah.
So that is a myth. So you cannot have a quid pro quo relationship, because that's a signal that there's a red flag. Really, both people need to be serving and trying to help each other as much as possible where you're not keeping track of each other, because, again, things won't always be fair right now. So,
is it something that typically happens, though, in a relationship, becoming an emotional accountant? You know, and
what makes somebody become an emotional accountant?
Well, I mean, I guess it's a person. Is it a personality type, though? Because
I can't necessarily say that it's a personality type that becomes an emotional accountant. Usually, if someone has this idea that you're going to wrong me or that I'm going to be treated unfairly, sometimes they go into a relationship with a general mistrust. And so there's a variety of things that could lead someone to becoming an emotional accountant. However, what we know is that when they do, that's not a good sign. That's a red flag in a relationship. And so not that things can't change in the future, but, you know, hey,
yeah.
You know. I was just laughing
because I was thinking of a friend that right after they got married, and she started saying, it's serve yourself dinner. And her husband said, what do you mean serve yourself? You know, because I guess before they got married, she must have served him a lot. But it just made me think of it. I always thought it was kind of funny.
Right.
And they did end up in a divorce. So there you go, right?
Interesting. She gave him my card. So myth number two, I would say, is that extramarital affairs cause divorce. What we know is that most people actually, whenever they have an affair, typically, especially if they're married, they usually actually stay together, especially if they're just one affair. Now, if someone is chronically cheating, that's another issue. But the research points out that extramarital affairs typically are a consequence of emotionally distant partners.
Mm.
And so extramarital affairs represent a lack of friendship and intimacy within the partner relationship. Like, so there were some things breaking down that opened the door to the affair happening. And again, this is most relationships. Again, there are some people who find themselves in affairs who didn't plan on it. Most people don't actually plan on it, you know. However, there are some people that go looking for it. I'm not the one to judge somebody if they have an affair. However, again, if they have an agreement that there's a monogamous relationship and there's an affair that happens, usually there were some breakdowns in communication, trust, and intimacy that led up to the affair. So,
well, what are some of the other myths and truths?
Okay, so number three, you've heard me talk about this before, that monogamy is for women. So most people tend to think that men are more sexually promiscuous, but nowadays, you women are outpacing us in terms of having those extramarital affairs. Like, you guys are getting out and having sex. That's pretty much what that boils down to.
Well,
and so,
I don't know what to say about that. I don't know what to say about that. I'm not saying I'm Miss Goody Two Shoes, but I've never cheated on anyone, nor would I. But I'm not judging other people that have, because you never, unless you've walked in somebody's shoes, you cannot judge them. So,
I wish I could say the same, Bernadette, but, you know, I had partners in the past that I cheated on. And, I mean, I've never cheated on my wife, but, you know, whenever I was out there, I was out there. I'll say it like that. So,
you were a dog. We all know that.
Wolf, baby. Yeah. So,
all right. So what's number four?
So I would say I'm gonna combine a few of these together. Gender differences don't cause divorce. Dominant structures, if one person is more dominant than the other, that does not cause divorce. As well as, you don't have to compliment your partner. So it's not like one person needs to be submissive and the other person needs to be domineering. So partners don't necessarily need to be complimentary to have a stable relationship. It's really what that couple sees as fairness within the relationship. Their perception of power or imbalances of power and the perception within the relationship, that's what makes relationships healthy. And to that end, even when people have family of origin issues, like let's say you come from a bad childhood, or if you have like baggage in the past from like past relationships where a partner cheated on you, all those types of things don't necessarily cause the dissolution of the relationship. It's really about how the couple deals with it in the relationship. Is there respect? Is there affection? Is there autonomy? Is there interdependence where they're both, depending on each other, rather than the projection of past conflict, past childhood wounds, different things like that. So, and to that end, you've heard me talk about this before, that most issues in relationships are perpetual either way. So conflict resolution is a misguided goal. So it's really about how you manage the conflict, because my childhood wounds aren't going anywhere. This may be a perpetual issue in the relationship. However, how we deal with it, do you accept me for who I am? That's what's most important. Mm-hmm. And those are some myths of, dysfunctional relationships.
Yeah. Well, I think that you should always accept the other person, but I don't feel that that means that you can accept infidelity.
Oh, no. That's a totally different thing. So, when we talk about accepting your behavior, we're not talking about things that you do to violate trust. Like, I'm just going to keep trusting you as you continue to, do things that will cause me to mistrust you. Like, that's another whole issue right there. So,
always,
but, you know.
Yeah. No, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just heard the music. I don't know if you can hear. But gosh, it always blows by with you so fast because we always have so much fun. Von Eaglin, thank you so much. It was great. And we're going to have to do something about it. We'll have to put you on at the beginning of the show so we don't get cut short. But always a pleasure. Always great information. Von Eaglin, you can follow him on Instagram at Von Talks or find him at PrestonPlaceCounseling.com. Thanks, Von. Always great.
All right. Take care.
All right, you too. Everyone, I hope you enjoyed the show. I really enjoyed it today. I did. And thank you so much for listening. You get one body, you get one mind, and you get one life. Get out there today and make the most of it.